What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review on this Christmas week. We'll take a look at the top stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on the show, there's chaos for Christmas travelers in Papua New Guinea, with passengers forced to sleep on terminal floors. Pacific nations are increasingly being linked to shadow fleets, transporting illegal oil and avoiding sanctions. And a new Pacific Rugby League team is making its bid to join the NRL. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, after more than 20 years in the PNG music industry, award-winning artist Mal Maningakuri says he's fighting a battle to save the authentic sound and spirit of Papua New Guinea's legendary performers. The threat comes from AI, artificial intelligence, and the rising prevalence of computer-generated cover versions of songs that offer no financial benefit to their creators. His campaign is gathering momentum, and as Richard Ewitt reports, there's growing support not just from the music industry, but from the corridors of power as well.
One Vibe Production.
Cover version of a classic song, the late Daniel Billup's Promise, and it's generating a lot of love on YouTube. Its creators insist their intention is to celebrate incredible artistry. But Daniel's brother-in-arms, Mal Maningakuri, doesn't see it that way. Instead, he sees a piece of work by AI and a song taken without permission.
People are trying to use it to gain more popularity and fame, but they don't see the main impact that it can give to us musicians and artists. If we, as an individual who has interest in music, use it as a tool to do our music with our own lyrics, own voice, and then you can tell AI to do your, create your music, but they are not doing that way. They're using songs released by legend artists to create a cover version, which is not right. If they monetize their YouTube, then they're making money out of it. And we can say they're stealing someone's hard work.
So what can be done to stop this from happening? Mal's view is that streaming services like Spotify and YouTube should ensure that all AI-generated music is identified as such. And where songs have been taken without permission, they should be removed.
Yes, definitely. If cover version done by AI is uploaded on their platform, they must remove it, because that's a total 100% copyright. It's not for me to talk about this, but especially those international artists can speak up for everyone.
The powers that be have responded to Mal's concerns, and he was invited to talks with the Department of Information, Communication and Technology. And PNG's chief censor, Jim Abani, says problems with AI first came to his attention at a time when his office was promoting a campaign to ensure that music lived up to required standards of decency.
The first issue brought up on AI-generated music was in Lae, when we had a workshop on music regulation to ensure that it is appropriate for PNG listeners, and also it must be within our country's values and context that we want to promote.
Government, you have to do something to protect your people. We musicians and artists are part of this country, and we are the one who promotes our country to the outside world so that the tourists can come. It's something that will help us boost tourism.
Say we go. sinko down under Goa Market. Won't give me you like a Sumatin. KBC, now you me been around one time.
Well, the chief censor has promised action, but he says there is a need for government departments to join forces to assist artists to protect their copyright.
All of government approach is the only way that we can assist our local artists. Regulating AI music in Papua New Guinea, there are some potential strategies that I can recommend for agencies within the space to help our local artists. One of them is the copyright law. If it is outdated, we need to review that. Licensing and royalties is something that we have to establish this licensing to give that rightful owners so that they can benefit.
Although he's leading the charge against AI copies, Mal says he's not a victim, at least not yet, and he wants to educate people about how he believes AI should be used in the PNG music industry.
Most of us, we are using auto-tunes and we record music in studios with computers, but for you to put your vocal in, you have to be authentic. Your voice has to be there so that people will see. People will know, people will understand, and then people will invite you to come and perform live. You cannot tell AI to sing songs for you on stage.
But a quick glance at the comments under any of the AI-generated covers online right now tells you that listeners don't know the songs are not real, or that the artists don't actually exist, and they love the song so much, they want more. And that's what concerns Malmaninga Kuri most, the thought that what he calls the flavour and spirit of music made in Papua New Guinea is being put at risk.
My concern is the taste that we had from the original artist will fade away. When it fades, the name of the legend will die off. The new generation that are coming up, they won't even know that it's from a senior artist. They will think that the original artist is the AI producer. The culture and the tradition and the taste of PNG music that is dying out because of AI.
First time to room, been meeting you. Now meeting you.
AI created music from Papua New Guinea, which Malmaninga Kuri says risks tearing the heart out of the PNG music industry. And the reporter there was Richard Ewitt. And staying in Papua New Guinea, it's been a chaotic festive season for air travelers, with delayed flights disrupting travel plans and forcing some passengers to sleep on the floor of the domestic terminal. Retired public servant Mensa Wagun was assisting grieving family members travel when their casket containing the body of a loved one was delayed at Port Moresby. She told ABC reporter Hilda Wayne that the national carrier, Air New Guinea, needs to suspend further ticket sales until the backlog of waiting passengers is cleared.
The scene was very chaotic because usually the passengers would be outside the terminal and you can physically see them. But during that period, yeah, somehow they allowed everybody, the passengers, including those who are checking them into the check-in terminal. It was all chaotic because anybody was mixing up all the online ticketers, tourists who came in, plus the cash tickets, and most of them were dealing with cash tickets. So passengers decided to sleep inside the check-in area, not outside anymore. But in the past, it was outside. This time, they had to go inside. So women and children and everyone who were traveling, including tourists, were inside, lying all, you know, hungry, starving. And it was almost very stressful for them. So I also happened to go inside, and then I saw it with my own eyes.
And that was retired public servant and Port Moresby resident Mensa Wagun speaking there to the ABC's Hilda Wayne. And the ABC has sought comment from Air New Guinea. You're listening to Pacific Review, and we're taking a look at our top stories on this Christmas week. Pacific nations are increasingly finding themselves associated with so-called shadow fleets, which are being used to transport black market oil. New figures show more than 100 dark fleet ships currently sail under Pacific Nation flags, 49 from Palau, 27 from Marshall Islands, and 22 from Cook Islands. The ships, which are often old and poorly maintained, are often linked to Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, and are believed to be carrying illegal oil. Jennifer Parker from the ANU's Security College says complaints have been raised against the open ship registry belonging to Pacific nations like Cook Islands.
There are at least five, I think maybe a couple more, open registries in the Pacific. Now, these are registries that are set up for commercial purposes. So a country will choose to register a vessel, but it has no linkage to the ownership of that vessel to that country. And a good example is kind of the Cook Islands right now. So the Cook Islands was determined to, in December, have about 20 sanctioned vessels under US sanctions on their registry and about 15 under the British sanctions list. So there's no genuine connection between the state and that ship. It becomes a commercial transaction. And what we see with these shadow fleets is, to avoid being caught up in sanctions or held accountable for their behaviour, these ships will chop registries and they'll move to countries who are not going to pay much attention to, is that ship dodgy? What is it doing? Is it on a sanctions list? Has it been breaching IMO regulations? Is it breaching labour regulations? So often Pacific countries, because they have limited ability, because their population size, their budget size, to really enforce these rules on these ships or really do due diligence onto what are the ships they're registering, they're often seen as targets for these dodgy vessels to register with those flag states.
Are Pacific nations potentially, like, could they potentially find themselves liable or risk reputational damage if their flag is associated with some of these ships, particularly if they go on to, you know, cause maritime incidents or disasters?
They definitely can find themselves liable. So you're right. The Eagle S was a flag to the Cook Islands. It was arrested by Finland in late 24 and accused of cutting a series of seabed cables. And an important thing to know, that these shadow fleets don't just support sanctions busting. They also often create maritime security issues. So there's been allegations of attacking maritime infrastructure, environmental issues, et cetera, but in terms of liability of Pacific Islands that choose to register these vessels, yes. So there is very clearly reputational risk. And what happens with that is if a country is seen to be flagging these vessels that don't comply with IMO regulations, that create safety and environmental risks and bust sanctions, then you might find that other ports won't allow vessels flagged to that country in anymore, or insurers might refuse to work with that registry. So there's kind of that reputational risk. From a legal risk, absolutely, because as I mentioned, under the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, it is flag states that are responsible for ensuring that their vessels comply.
Many of these ships kind of seem to operate in plain sight. What prevents authorities from monitoring them or regulating their activity? And I guess by an extension of that, what stops Pacific Island ship registries from being able to properly monitor them so they can deregister them, I guess?
With everybody having access to Google Maps and things like Marine Tracker, we seem to think that we live in a world where we know where everything is at every time. But actually, when it comes to the oceans, that's not the case. So, you know, 70% of the world is ocean, and it's really hard to track what is happening across those oceans. What makes it harder with these shadow fleets? One, they often don't use AIS. So every ship above a certain size, so certainly all these tankers, have to use the automatic identification system under the International Maritime Organization's regulations. But most of them turn it off or they'll fake their position. So, for example, one of the ships seized by the US over the weekend was saying that it was at sea off Guyana when it was, in fact, alongside in Venezuela. The second element is they often change their flags of registration. They often change their names or paint over their names or put fake names in their AIS system or fake destinations.
And that was Jennifer Parker from the Australian National University's Security College speaking there to the ABC's Kyle Evans. One of Australia's flagship development programs has come under significant criticism this year for putting its participants in danger of exploitation. The Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme employs more than 30,000 workers from Pacific Island countries, including Timor-Leste. Some, who have reported unfair pay deductions, poor working and living conditions, and a lack of support which has led them to leave the program entirely. But the experience of Pacific workers hasn't been all negative. One group of meat workers in a rural Queensland town are looking forward to adding some Fijian flair to their festive season.
I really do enjoy the work here. At first it's kind of hard, but I get used to it.
That's Simeone Lunalotu from Latoka in Fiji's west.
My auntie came here 4 years ago working in the meatwork, and then she encouraged me to go and apply for a farm scheme program. And then I just go and try to apply, and then here I am. My motivation is to earn money for myself and for my family.
Joining the Palm Scheme 4 years ago, he works for Tees Australia, a meatworks. His friend, Kitione Samo, also from the western side of Fiji, works there too.
I came because of my family. Things are expensive back home, and it's very tough. My mom is a provider at home. She is a market vendor. And my father is a sugarcane farmer. Yeah, so they encouraged me, why don't you try going to Australia and work? And I said, okay. And I applied for the scheme and I got through.
Both work in Bilawila, a town in central Queensland which was thrust into the national spotlight for its Back to Billow campaign, a community effort to return the Tamil family who'd been removed from their home by immigration officials in 2018. After 4 years in detention, they were returned home, and the rural town earned a reputation for its welcoming and multicultural community.
When I first came here, when we landed, when we reached here, it was nighttime, around 8. When we went to our unit, I was surprised when there was a knock on the door. And then I looked out, there were two couples. They said, we are John and Oni. We are the leader for the Fijian community. I was so surprised. I was so happy. I was very happy when there's a Fijian community here. It feels like home.
Kitione says the local community has embraced Palm Scheme workers.
I found everyone was really friendly, and they socialize with everyone. I haven't experienced any racism here in Biloela. They were all welcoming. Yeah.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it really surprised me. It really surprised me.
And with Christmas just around the corner, taro, cassava and seafood will be on the menu, with the local Bilawila butcher stocking Pacific delicacies.
I'll be celebrating Christmas with the Fijian community here. We just have a few of us here, and we'll do a little celebration on Christmas.
Simeone said having such a strong Fijian community in town and attending church has made Bilawila feel like a home away from home.
We go for a walk that day, and I told my friend, I think I like this place because it's quite simple, and it's kind of like my town back at home. It's not that fancy, but it's cool. It's really nice. We are so lucky that we have some ladies, Fijian ladies, who have been here for years, and that always encourage us, call us, and remind us in some meeting. They remind us for who we are in our culture, so we don't have to forget our culture even though we come to Australia.
Both say they haven't had any bad experiences with the scheme. Here's Kitione again.
For me, it was a good experience, but whenever I have any problem with them, I go directly to them. I ask them and they fix the problem, and they let me know if it's been fixed.
And when asked if they could change one thing about the scheme, what would it be? They both said the length of the visa.
If there's a chance to extend this for another 3 years, that would be great.
And those were Fijian Palm Scheme workers, Simeone Lunalotu and Kitione Samo, speaking there to the ABC's Lucy Cooper in Bilawela. The year 2026 could prove to be a landmark one for rugby league in the Pacific, with the organisation behind the Auckland-based bid to set up a Polynesian-owned club in the NRL set to step up its campaign. With a fresh round of TV rights negotiations set to begin in 2027, the Mana Pacifica bid team believe they can play a key role in helping the NRL to secure a bigger deal if they're given a licence. On the field, they say they have a big-name coach ready to go and connections with a raft of Pacifica players who are keen to be part of their squad. And now, as Richard Ewart reports, New Zealand's hip-hop icon King Kampisi has come on board to promote a bid which he views as the start of a cultural movement celebrating the Pacific's role in rugby leagues.
Tell your boys to raise up, cause we tell the roof off, we rip the stage off, when we rock, y'all. It goes on and on, it's non-stop, y'all. It goes on and on.
I've played in each city, I've played all over Australia multiple times over the last 30 years. So I'm able to talk to mayors, talk to MPs, having the profile that I have. Most of the people at some stage in the last 30 years have listened to my music. So, you know, I have a certain influence now. And the thing with my music, I still haven't stopped. And we've done other things at a clothing label, started my charitable trust. So I'm very community orientated.
A leading figure on the New Zealand music scene for many years, King Kampisi is passionate about his Samoan roots and passionate about helping to establish an NRL franchise that will create pathways for young Polynesians. And the director of the Mana Pacifica bid, Jeff Mulianga-Brown, says Kapisi's involvement is a huge boost to their campaign.
King Kapisi has been in the industry for over 30 years, and he was one of the first Polynesian artists to break into Australian market. When it comes to the challenges we're facing, he brings that mindset that, you know, it's achievable. These things are important to our people. The biggest thing he said to me was, how are these kids supposed to identify if we can't even see our own people being part of the leadership of a club? We want to encourage our kids to have careers in the NRL. Why can't they be CEOs? Why can't they be the head of recruitment? 60% of Polynesians aren't playing in the NRL. No Polynesian owns a team.
So clearly there is much more to the Mana Pacifica bid than putting a team together. If the bid is successful, then the intention is for the club to be Pacifica-owned and run. And Director Brown believes if the NRL gives them the nod sooner rather than later, their presence will be financially beneficial for the league right from the start.
It's already been recommended that they get 20 teams. Our position, we're very strong. We've got a lot of good people around us. We're talking to investors. We haven't gone to government for support, but we've got island nations backing the bid, but we're also talking to private sector. We're talking to people that actually run global businesses. The NRL, they want to grow the audience. To grow the audience, you need more money. And right now, with the TV rights, which they negotiate in 2027, that's when they've got to finalise their deal.
We have two other bids here, and, you know, I wish them all the best, but I think that we've done our due diligence by, you know, locking in places like Eden Park, the Cape Town, other places down here in the South Island where I am now, but also being able to talk to governments back home in the Pacific Islands and being able to actually ask them, would you guys like to have some games there? And so, you know, we're looking pretty good. We've got a whole bunch of players that are willing to come in from Matamatonga all the way down to the under 17, under 16 ranges. So finding teams for our men and one for our ladies won't be a hard thing.
Right now, the Mana Pacifica bid team can't be sure where they stand with the NRL, and the timeline for a decision is not clear, but they have a well-connected advisor who is tapping into the vibe at NRL HQ.
He's been working with us, but also working with the NRL, and he's former COO of the NRL. He's been involved with us from the start, so we've been getting feedback from him in regards to what the NRL are doing. I think the big difference with us, we're a bit more current. We're not guessing on coaches. We have a coach, and if we announce the coach today, it'll turn a lot of heads. And I've been involved in junior development programs across New Zealand, the Pacific, for 15 years. 30% of my players are now playing in the NRL, 30% of them. And our NRL players through our systems and through our pathways. We're not going to struggle to put teams together. We've said that from the start.
While no one knows in which direction the NRL will eventually decide to go or when, Jeff Brown says his organisation are already on the start line and planning for their debut season as the second club in New Zealand's most populous city.
We're actually working like we're getting ready for 2028. And it's not something we've just come out of the woodworks like all the other bids that are out there. We're current. We know the marketplace. We're working with high-level individuals. You know, we've got the mayors back in it, stadium back in it. Actually, we have multiple stadiums back in the bid. About 300,000 to 400,000 Polynesian people living in Auckland. And I was asked the other day, why do we need another team? And I went, well, Sydney has nine teams. I don't know why we're questioning Auckland when Sydney has nine teams and we have one.
And if Mana Pacifica succeed, as everyone involved clearly believes they will, then King Kapisi has another important role he wants to play.
If anyone's going to create an anthem for the Mana, it's going to be me. And so, you know, I've had ideas, thrown beats around and all that type of thing. So I'm consistently making reggae music, making dance music, making drum and bass music, making rap music. So the music thing, you know, I can do that with my eyes closed these days. I've been doing it for a long time and I've mastered my skill and I've also become good at marketing, and that's the skills that I bring to Mana Pacifica.
And that was hip-hop star King Kapisi, a man on a mission who won't stop until he's helped to secure a place for Mana Pacifica in the NRL alongside the Papua New Guinea Chiefs. The reporter there was Richard Ewitt. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company, and join us again same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific region.